Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the 10th in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas, and I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel is to derive, through questions posed to the participants, an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today we have three very lovely ladies with us. We have Lisa Boyles, Roxanne Puckett, and someone who is not unfamiliar to this place, but first time on this panel, Judy Getty. And my first question is involving the topic of sexual harassment, the Me Too movement. Did I just cross the line by referring to you lovely ladies as lovely ladies?
And I think that's going to be what we're talking about today is where is that line? And when you said it, I thought, uh-oh, he's already starting. But, you know, my filter's set pretty high. And so I think when we do have the conversation today, I think we're going to hear that people set that bar at different places.
So are we talking about arbitrary filters now? Because you said yours is set pretty high.
I think they're individual filters, and I think there's cultural filters.
I think, definitely.
I think everybody comes from a different place in their different upbringing in their life, and so they have maybe different experiences, or they can handle a different threshold, and so they're going to have different opinions on what's going to be acceptable behavior to them, maybe that would be not acceptable to somebody else, like lovely ladies, in a simple terms, not.
Lisa, what's your take?
Well, I actually have had older women from the first or second generation now feminist movement get upset that I use the word lady.
Right.
Because they said we fought really hard for that. But I do believe it's individual. And I think it's kind of like, it depends on the person and their culture. And sometimes even, I hate to say this, but how are you feeling that day, you know? You know, if you're not in a good mood and someone says you're lovely and you don't feel lovely and, you know, at work, you take, well, thank you, you know. So, yeah, it really is kind of esoteric. I really think it is.
Well, let's not forget that it can also be dependent on who's delivering the message.
That's true, too.
So if we were, say, 18-year-old girls here sitting, or young women, and you said that, not that you're old, Paul, but older.
Oh, well,
and we might think,
older.
What is this dirty old man saying,
right.
You know? And so there could be an age difference. That can be a piece of it also.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So we're also thinking about this perspective is this guy trying to hit on me as well, right?
Right, or is he just being nice because maybe his generation has a different way of talking to just people in general. And I get called sweetheart all the time by an older gentleman, and I don't think that he means it in a derogatory. He's like 80, and he just – but someone might get offended and they're 18, and they're younger, and they think that's kind of creepy. Why would he think I'm lovely? He needs to be looking at women his own age. That might be another issue.
But on the other hand, I am kind of a mouthy female, so if I had three good-looking guys, I might say, and I'm joined by these three handsome gentlemen, you
right.
know, so, I mean, it's all in how you take it, gosh,
And I think receivers of those messages are trying to figure out what's the intent here.
Navigate,
and I think that's part of what we're saying is, is this a come on? Are they just being nice? Are they being complimentary? Are they trying to get a rise out of me? And so I think that women are caught up in that kind of internal conversation.
Right. So we're talking about mind reading here a little bit, too. When you say about intent, you don't really know the intent unless you can crawl into his brain.
Or ask him if you have that type of confidence to say, well, what the heck does that mean? If it offends you, but a lot of people won't say that.
I like your attitude when you said that, though. what do you mean by that?
Yeah, because I can personally be like that, but a lot of women I know and people in general are not like that. They're very they're just different, I think it again goes back to how maybe you're raised or your culture or the environment that you're around.
That's very true. I took an international communication class, an upper level last semester, well, the last semester before I graduated. And that definitely showed me how I have to kind of stop and think before I speak in diverse groups, especially like in Anchorage. And I'm very loud and I'll have open my, you know, you really do have to stop and think because, and it's not fearful of being politically correct. It's just you might hurt some feelings.
You might be a little bit aggressive. Right?
Aggressive, or I could hurt feelings, or just something what I would just slip off my back might not. And it really, in culture, was very important. And so I see, you know, there is a different culture between men and women.
So can we conclude that cultural sensitivity is something we all need to get better at?
I really think so, yes.
Okay, there have been some very high-profile accusations of sexual misconduct in the recent past. Bill Clinton, Bill Cosby, Senator Bob Packwood, Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly, Donald Trump. But after Harvey Weinstein, all hell broke loose in the media, entertainment, political, and international scenes. What happened that emboldened the onslaught of accusers that took down Charlie Rose, Kevin Spacey, John Conyers, Mark Halperin, Al Franken? And it all seemed to occur after Harvey Weinstein. What happened at that moment that caused this onslaught? Any ideas on that?
Well, I think we've got kind of a atmosphere, I think, that's emboldening women right now in general. I think that the Women's March in January of 2017, the resistance movement with women coming forward and speaking out and taking action on a number of different things has really emboldened women in general.
And especially with Harvey Weinstein, if you were ever, like I lived in New York for a little bit, he is like the epitome of, you know, when you meet him and he approves of you, male or female, and he can make you a star. And that really has its own culture. And so I think being able to take him down was really like, oh, they're listening now. Because, I mean, what always threw me was the Courtney Love's quote in 2005 when someone asked her at some awards thing, you know, what would you tell some young up-and-coming, you know, aspiring actress? Don't have lunch with Harvey Weinstein is what she said. And
years
that's 2005. Yeah.
Right.
So
12 years later.
You were seeing this. So I think all of a sudden what had become the norm, you know, and to see him start, people start to listen because like what Judy said, and then react and do stuff. Here's this really big guy, Democrat too, progressive. Oh my gosh, everyone adored him. Yeah, being taken down, it really emboldened it. It filled that up, you know, I guess it fed that emboldening, you know.
And I think the media had a part too with it, you know, it's just different than 12 years ago, Facebook, Twitter, things like that. You have this totally different and incredible opportunity to reach millions of people. And with the political deal going on last year and a lot of the Hollywood big people were following them. People were paying attention to what they were saying about the political movement. And then with the Women's March in January, it just kept pushing and pushing, and as people were more aware of it, and these high profile like Harvey, and then all these other subordinates, if you will, in that Hollywood, because they're kind of looked up to, and I that's what I think. I think of people in a higher power in this Hollywood, this kind of unrealistic life that people like us, maybe who don't have that glamour, will look up to it, and I think that's important in this, that it helped move a lot of things forward on a bigger scale. Because of media.
How do you explain or account for the Access Hollywood tapes' effect on Donald Trump's 20-point victory margin with white women? Do you understand that question?
Yes.
It's horrible.
And I guess, you know what? Thank you for asking if we understand. I understand the question. Our first impulse is just to drop our mouth open and just like, you know, it's embarrassing for white women. I think that any subgroup that voted for Trump, whether it's white women or the evangelicals, they have had to, you know, silo some of the things that he says so that they can turn off. Okay, well, I'm just going to ignore that because I don't agree with that, but I do agree with, you know, this over here. And I mean, I don't know how else. I mean, it's a cognitive dissonance. You can't hold those two things in your brain at the same time. So you have to like ignore one of them.
Whichever the easiest one maybe to be to ignore, which is the one that you agree with or don't agree with. You don't want to ignore.
No, I agree totally. And I think it's also kind of almost like a, oh, come on, that was just locker room talk. You know, I'm going to be brave and overlook that. You know, I'm one of the guys. I'm, you know, a lot of them, and some even gentler, more Christian women that I met, they blamed it on the media. And right. I remember just saying that was his voice. That was called a sound bite. You know,
that was normal.
He was shaking the Tic Tacs.
Yeah.
We could hear the Tic Tacs shaking. It so he was getting ready to.
Yeah. So, I mean, they blame the media. They kind of turned their head because they had other ulterior motives to gain through him.
No, they rationalize it
and so
that they can live with their decision. And
make themselves feel better about the way that the country is going.
So in regard to the earlier question, I seemed to get the impression that it was the political desperation of women, maybe with the election of Donald Trump as president, that sort of acted as a catalyst to get this Me Too thing going. With Harvey Weinstein.
It could have, because it was such a huge impact. I mean, I'm 27, and I watched when Bush got elected and everything. And it just seems like with this election, it was so intense, if you will, by which what you're watching. And I think it just, a lot of people came together. And that's kind of what you had. You weren't by yourself in a lot of views, whether it was sexual harassment or whatever. And then I think that kind of just built a base for women to finally say, okay, and men and other problems, to just say, we want to fix something. We want to change this. It's not normal. Who cares if it was normal 10, 15, 20, 100,000 years ago since women became women? It's the problem, and it always has been. And so I think that was a good base to start it.
This is KVRF Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. We are bridging the gap, discussing one of the many issues that divides us politically. Today the issue is the Me Too movement, sexual harassment, and pay equality. I'm going to talk with Lisa Boyles and Roxanne Puckett and Judy Getty regarding pay inequality. Is the reason this exists, this pay equality, inequality, I should say, with men and women due to the confidentiality of salaries? Because women can't really argue that the men are getting more paid more than they are whenever they really don't know and don't have access to the information of how much they get paid?
I think it depends. I guess if you have the access or not, that'll start that. I know that I've
Well, let me ask you. Did you have access to your coworkers?
I did in the management position that I was in. One of them, it was a friendship. So I was able, he asked me, you know, how much money I made, how much money he made. And we were in the same position. And we talked about it. And I had a lot more responsibilities with the same pay. Same title on paper. So it was, I don't think there was any room for argument on my side because it was the same title on paper. But I know that I did a lot more and had a lot more responsibilities on a regular day basis than that. And so then if you don't know, how can you argue that if you don't even have a clue? And then they'll say, well, you're just making that up. You just want attention or something, you know. But when you do know, you can't take that anywhere. Who do you go to and say, this is ridiculous, this is bullcrap, I do a lot more, how come I'm not getting paid more?
And it's certainly a red flag if you go to work in a company and they say you need to sign this confidentiality agreement,
right,
that you will not discuss your salary.
Which is very typical.
That's
very
how general, a large Fortune 500 company I worked for, that's how they did it, that you didn't disclose. But I think young people have they're lucky in being able to, it sounds funny, but to Google, mm-hmm, like the, you know, what a man, you know, because the Google doesn't know if you're male or female, and you could get kind of around about what you should expect. So there's a little bit more information out there now than there was when Judy and I would apply for jobs like that, because it was, I mean, you did not know. And it was just so forbidden to discuss salary with amongst your peers.
In general.
Yeah, in general,
I mean, I don't know. Again, I think there's some cultural aspect to this, mm-hmm, that I was raised in. You don't ask about money. You don't talk about money.
Yeah.
That's even with family.
That's
right.
True, too. Yeah.
And so to bring that up in a work setting would have never occurred to me.
Like, how dare, mm-hmm, you even think that?
Yeah.
To even ask that.
Right.
Know your place.
Lilly Ledbetter Law was the first major achievement of the Barack Obama's presidency. And that was passed all the way back in 2009. We're in 2018 now. Any comments on the lack of enforcement of that Lilly Ledbetter Law?
I don't have a lot of information on it, so I can't really respond.
So what was it? Like less than 2 years ago, we were 73 cents in Alaska to the dollar, a man-made. So it's, I don't know. I mean, I really think it there's always that fear of losing your job. Mm-hmm. And the way the economy's been, that's a little something of a carrot or a punishment that could be held over your head if you make a big deal about something like that.
Well, I think it's so disheartening that we're supposed to battle this one case at a time.
Yeah, exactly.
If there was just, you know, a pay equity act where people were given the same pay, not gender-based, and then, you know, I mean, that's huge, right? I know in the state of Alaska we had looked at things like that within the state government and, you know, people ask the question, why do daycare workers make less than garbage truck drivers? You know, and so where, you know, where, what do we value? How do we put a value on it? But that's a huge undertaking. But I think that's what it needs, because when every woman is expected to question her salary and take this as a case by case basis, is just going to take forever. And so we'll always have that pay difference.
Yep. It'll always be a problem.
It is my belief that in the industries of media, entertainment, and politics, sex appeal is a major attribute to an individual's success in those areas. That's me talking, though. Am I wrong?
No, the research backs you up on that. Mm-hmm. Tall people have advantages. Younger people have advantages. Certainly attractive people have advantages. And that even starts in grade school. Mm-hmm. The research says that children who are better looking, you know, on whatever norms you're talking about, the teachers treat them better, they have more friends, they do better in school.
Is this movement going to have any effect on that aspect of success in those industries? Or is it just going to go on as usual, regardless of what happens here with this Me Too movement?
Well, I would have to say it's going to differ by product or by merchandise or by whatever you're selling. You know what I mean? It'll be a service or a movie. Dove has really tried to get women to be more accepting of who they are. We do see a lot more clothes out there and heavier set models. So I think with the female consumer, we may see some changes with that. As far as, I was like, movies, probably not. That's really been hard to change, to get the average size woman in a movie role, a lead role. But you have Melissa McCarthy. You know, you're starting to see more. So I think probably with women in that respect, men, well, I can't speak for men, but, you know, I just know, you know, I don't know. It's hard to say. I'd like to see it, but I don't think so.
And I think there is more of a push. And I think when women in media are allowed to make those decisions, then that becomes less of a factor. Mm-hmm. And so when women have more say, whether they're directors or producers or, you know, when you brought up Melissa McCarthy, but I was thinking of Kate Winslet, because even, you know, 20 years ago when she was in movies, and she's not a tiny person, she's not a huge person, but she's, you know, is average for women. Mm-hmm. And so when she said, I'm not going to slim down and this is who I am, I think that was the start of some of the bigger names being able to have that power.
But she's still very attractive, Kate Winslet.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And talented.
Mm-hmm. All right. This is KVRF Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. Today we're talking about sexual harassment, the Me Too movement, pay inequality. And I have with me Lisa Boyles, Roxanne Puckett, and Judy Getty, discussing one of the issues that divide us politically. Is workplace romance among coworkers a bad thing?
I think so, in some ways. I guess it depends on how you present yourself as an individual before you get into that workplace or in that relationship. I personally, I've met my spouse at my job, but we don't work together because I think that barrier, it's hard to, I don't know how to explain it, but
your spouse,
you get stuck.
You said you met your spouse at work.
I met mine at work, but we don't.
But you think it's a bad thing.
I do.
So what does that
I do
tell
because
you
I see
that?
A lot of it, and I say that, and that's why I said the individuality. It depends on how you can handle yourself. Like when we started seeing that it was becoming a problem I'm his subordinate. So, like, I'm not even allowed to do that, technically, in my opinion, in my work experience, in any other company, I wouldn't be able to. I see other people, though, that don't take their extra initiative to be careful how they present themselves in the workforce when there's no, like, boundary between relationship and work. And I can see that can cause a serious problem with maybe new people coming in and seeing that, that it's okay to, it's acceptable behavior to maybe bring in ridiculous relationship problems into your workforce. And then you may not feel comfortable to address somebody for the same problem that's maybe not in a relationship with you, if that makes sense.
Professionally, like admonish or do, yeah.
But you may not feel like, well, what's the point? They're just going to go tell their husband and I'm not going to get anywhere or whatever. And then that might kind of radiate into the rest of, your morale just gets destroyed, in my opinion, of your whole system. Your base is ruined.
So it can become a hostile work environment.
Be. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it works out. Like with me and my spouse, we just don't work on the same day. We don't do, see, you know, we keep it very boundaried, but I have seen people, like I said, and it does destroy the environment. And maybe somebody might not feel more as comfortable to go approach them if there was a problem of their own, maybe with some other coworker.
So have you seen any problems with your husband?
He's like one of the nice guys, I guess. I don't know. I know he has to deal with a lot of the problems with him being a higher. I'm a kind of the bottom deal, so I don't really worry about it. But I've had to see him deal with the repercussions of, let's say, the couple that's in a higher arc. They're together. He has to maybe work around their, you know, let's say one of them's irritated at the other at a workplace. And it does, like a hostile work environment, that you have to, I call it playing the game. You have to play the game depending on who's in the what mood, at what time, and where you're at. And I think he has to do that a lot more than myself because he's like in the middle of that power, if you will. And it does rub off. People get really irritated. People have left because of it, because of the environment that has been created if they're, like I said, in a bad mood. Sometimes it's fine. Sometimes there's no big deal. I've also worked with people who are in a relationship that it doesn't, it's not hostile. But I think it does create a problem with that when you talk about specifically higher levels, like let's say you're, you know, just a cashier and a manager. I think that causes serious problems because what if something does happen that you thought that it wasn't welcomed and you can't really go to that anybody, maybe HR or anything, because they're like, well, you guys were dating. Why is it a problem now?
Or like what we saw, like that our big company, it was totally not allowed.
Right.
We did have a couple of couples doing it outside of work. But when they went to work, there was this decorum that you know. But we also had, we had a pretty temporary receptionist come in, and one of the managers liked her. And so that was very hostile because she was afraid to say anything.
Right.
He was asking her out to lunch. And I was very glad GE had the rules, like, so we could intercede and said, stop. Stop now. You know, this is not allowed. You know, if you want to leave the company and pursue, that's entirely. But because you could really see in her face that she really wanted to keep this job. And he was a, you know, subordinate. You
yeah.
know? So not subordinate. Yeah.
Superior.
Sorry. Yeah. She was a subordinate.
That's the biggest problem when you have that.
Yeah.
That gap. That's where you get really. It gets
and
tricky.
I felt horrible for her. You know, I mean, it was just. Yeah.
Well, I will say that I also met my husband at work. And since we were in corrections, I like to say we met in prison. And, you know, and there, we had a commissioner at one time in the Department of Corrections who said that so many people were meeting their spouses in corrections that we were incestuous because of that. But I think that, you know, I agree with, you know, what you both said. And I think the other trick can be, what if a couple splits up?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the kind of work environment where now people are kind of forced to take sides. It's almost like, you know, in a split up in a family or within a friend group, that people will now be, you know, siding with one or the other. I mean, they can become such distractions at work. And so I think it really takes an effort on the part of the two individuals to, you know, keep it very personal, mm-hmm. have good boundaries,
right.
You know, that your personal and your professional lives are very separate.
So two out of the three panelists here have married the people that they met at work.
So.
Mm-hmm. I never even dated anyone from work.
And I've heard a lot of women say they will not. They won't even go there. They don't care if they like the guy or vice versa. Men say, no, we're not going there.
Be
and
friends.
I don't blame them.
That's about it. Yeah.
I'm reminded of the movie Good Night and Good Luck about Edward R. Murrow.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever they had the two people that were actually married that were working for CBS at the time, they had to keep it secret. And then they mm-hmm. finally, it was exposed that they were married. One of them had to quit.
That happens a lot, I think. That people.
And that's
realize.
What happened within this one couple that I said they were keeping right. it on the down low. And they only were able to, I guess, come out when she transferred to another branch.
Or quit or something.
Yeah, and then once she was not, you know, over him. and they were not, you know, then they could actually act, you know, they could be married and attend functions together. But it was about a year or two of keeping it quiet.
When we look historically, you know, you talk about Murrow's time period, the expectation was the woman would quit.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, I mean, for women to make the decision that, okay, I'm going to have this personal relationship could also mean I have to quit my job.
Yeah.
Or look for a job. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What role do men have in this Me Too movement?
I think they're very important.
Well, like Sarah Grimke said, get your foot off my neck. You know, so if men weren't being inappropriate, there wouldn't even be a Me Too movement is the starting point, I think.
But say there's a man that sees all this and believes that this is a good thing, that the women really need to get out from under this yoke of sexual harassment. Is there anything that you think that they could do to help out with that?
Absolutely. I think that when we look at any similar kind of thing, whether it's you know, the work they're doing in sexual assault or the work they're doing with kids and bullying, it's called the bystander movement. And so men who are in that circle and they see coworkers who are being inappropriate is to step up and to say, mm-hmm. you know, you're crossing the line. You know, you might think you're only kidding around, but that might not be how she's taking it. So I think men could also help police other men's behavior.
I agree with that, and I think it's really important that they do that. And again, it goes back to some people are with men are stronger than others as well. So if you have that personality to be a leader as a bystander and say, "Look, that's not okay," you should use that power that you have with your confidence and your own security to do that to help other people who maybe the other men who aren't as, like I said, men are subordinate too. It's not just women, and they're just maybe they're raised that way, and maybe they just are too afraid. So those leaders, I think, are really important for the movement.
They could get in trouble if they,
you know,
accuse someone.
If you feel confident as a man, and you feel like you don't care about the repercussions or whatever, it's just really exciting that some people will do it, and hopefully that more men who are leaders will do that.
And then, well, it goes back to also communication. Mm-hmm. Like, you were very open when you said, "Well, how was that opening?" I said, "Lovely ladies." Do you know, just this forum has made you stop and think, wow, something I would never have thought about. All of a mm-hmm. sudden, I'm thinking, wow, that might not be. So just asking someone, did I offend you? You know, and you know, I'm from back east, so I tend to say things without thinking. So I'm constantly, did I offend you? You know, being open to criticism that, you know, in a sense, it's not, you know, just, did I offend you with that? And thinking, being more cognizant of the next time I say it or how I talk to someone similar the next time, you know. So that, like, yeah, just being more aware and more communicative, too.
Well, and I think what you're getting at is that just as an individual, having insight and awareness mm-hmm. of how your behavior is affecting others.
Yeah.
Being able to receive that criticism without the pride and ego is going to be a huge deal, man or woman.
So is it okay for me to conclude that if you are a man and you see an injustice occurring, that is your responsibility to try to react or engage in some kind of activity that will try to right that injustice?
I think if you have the confidence and you have the base in your own individuality that you should.
And I guess the power, too. Right?
Yeah, and if you have the power, yeah.
And I just want to qualify that a little bit because I think one thing that women also resent is the thinking that men have to come to their rescue. Mm-hmm. And so, oh, don't worry, little lady. I'll stick up for you. That's not.
And then me and you can have a drink later, right?
Right.
Yeah, and then you can appreciate me, you know. So I think, you know, and I don't know if men, how they hear this, because they're thinking, geez, I can't do anything right.
Right.
You know? And so, but it's, I think it goes to intent and impact. They have to think about what am I trying to get out of this? And how is this affecting the people around me? And so I think if men go into it with the intent of, you know, just trying to help other men shape or think or be more aware of what they're doing, that's a clean intent. Mm-hmm. And then to think, okay, what's my impact? You know, is my impact that now this woman thinks I'm, you know, taking away her voice because she was going to say something? I need to, you know, maybe think about that and have some awareness about that and talk to her about that too. So that's another piece of it.
Or if my intent is to be a hero all the time.
And maybe mm-hmm. for some guys it is. And that's dangerous territory.
Is flirting okay? At what point does permissible flirting become inappropriate sexual advance?
And this is, I brought in the article because I wasn't aware of this, that the French had responded to the Me Too movement. And
Catherine Deneuve.
Yes. And mm-hmm. so they, you know, they're appalled. They, I guess the And it's not all French women. So, you know, it's that this letter was written saying that, you know, they're taking away flirting. And that's why, you know, when we started this conversation, we brought up the cultural piece, because I think in France, flirting may be seen as different. And then again, you know, maybe with French women, if someone is flirting with them on the job, they're more capable of saying, you know, stop, don't, you know, I don't like it. And there's no repercussions. I don't know.
Or they probably have the culture, you can flirt, and that's all it is. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't go beyond that. We're like, I know in some circumstances where I've had been questionable men around in work, and I'm not going to be alone in that office with them. You know what I mean? Even, you know what I'm saying? So in that culture, it's just the way they speak. It never goes beyond where you actually fear, wow, yeah.
And I think that word is the critical piece. What's the fear?
Is there fear?
Yep. Yeah. I know that I'm incredibly flirty. I don't mean to be, but I've been told constantly that I have a flirty personality. I'm not really sure what that means. But I think that's why it's such a problem right now, like with the boundaries and what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. I'm not being flirty. I'm not going out there and going, I really like that guy. I'm going to flirt with him until I get what I want. I'm just talking. I'm very bubbly. I talk.
It's misconstrued as
flirtatious. It is. And so I'm told. So now that if you've heard me, I think I'm flirty because people have told me that I'm flirty.
Are you flipping your hair or doing
really know, because I don't feel like I am. I'm just, I guess, giving attention to somebody. I get it because the women are who tell me that I'm flirty with men. And I'm thinking, gosh, I just asked if he wanted a piece of, you know, a tissue or, you know, some food or something. But I have this, I guess, this tone, body language. I don't know, but it comes across as incredibly flirty. So I think another problem is for women who maybe are like that or get told that, what are we doing that makes other women think that we're being flirty or other men think that we're being flirty?
So
because I don't
like
know.
You're conflicted between friendliness versus flirting.
I am, because I think I'm being friendly. And I think maybe I'm not the only person. And then other people kind of are like, you're just flirty. You're just like that. I don't think so.
Judy, you mentioned the key word was fear.
Yeah.
Is there any other ways in which, you know, flirting becomes sexually inappropriate, or that where that line is crossed?
No,
beyond
that is
fear?
A very good, Judy's saying fear, because it's different for everybody. And having, I have an autistic brother, and he says what's on his mind. He doesn't like to be touched. And if someone touches him, he has no trouble looking over and saying, don't touch me. He doesn't mean it meanly. He doesn't, and I've been around other people like that. Don't, you know, they just are just, I don't like being touched. And I think that's kind of what we need more. Women should be able to speak up along those lines. Because what might be just a little flirty to me, especially working in a male-dominated field for almost 20 years, you know, that bar was up and down, you know what I mean? And so might be offensive to someone else. So I think it's just, you know, it's hard to just say stop flirting, because we can't really define flirting. But I think if I start to feel uncomfortable, I should be able to look back and say, oh, okay, back up, you know?
And no repercussions.
Yeah, it bothers me when you touch me,
yeah,
you know, or
yeah,
whatever.
Or the, what
when
you just
you
said.
Say that,
yeah,
or call me that name.
Yeah.
But so the fear can be, you know, fear of, is he going to push himself on me? Is this going to turn into something like that? To, is this mean that I'm not going to get the promotion, or I'm going to be fired? So
it's kind of a gut feeling, and I think it's different with everybody. Mm-hmm. But I do have to tell you, most women, and it sounds, you know, kind of weird, but I think really when you rely on that gut feeling, you tend to be right, you know? And like I said, what might offend someone, I worked with a woman who was very hypersensitive, but she was also one of the first female engineers in this department. And so she was very hypersensitive to any kind of, but I didn't let a lot of that, I was younger. I didn't go what she went through. So the guys knew when she was around, they toned it down. They didn't, you know, they knew that would upset her. Because she was very vocal in saying that. So I think, but then some other women, you could be a little, not flirty, but you know what I mean? Like the jokes were a little bit more crass, and the woman would laugh, and a woman could say just as crass of a joke and get the same response. You know what I mean? It was just, but so it depends on the person. But I really think communication is really critical. And we really need to make women feel comfortable to say, hey, that made me uncomfortable, or whatever they want to say. You know, that was a little inappropriate, or, you know, smile, but you need to back up. You know what I mean? Be able to be able to say that without worrying about repercussion.
Yeah.
So the responsibility then, I'm concluding based on what you're saying, is that the responsibility is on the woman.
The initial
to communicate to the man, okay, this is a little bit much here.
Yeah.
And this is where, I don't know if you're specifically going to bring up the Aziz Ansari incident, but this is exactly what's at the core of this one. And, you know, I think for men, there may be a fear that now any woman can take it public and say, this is what this man did. And, you know, and men are left with, trying to question themselves and think, you know, maybe what Ansari did and said, well, I thought it was consensual. And I think some of the, you know, review of this case is saying that here's a woman that never said, and even in her complaint, she said, he wasn't picking up my nonverbal cues. And earlier you said something about being a mind reader. And I think, you know, what I guess my position would be, yes, I wish we could raise our girls and young women to feel comfortable and confident enough to say when they're uncomfortable and to say when it's enough. And that's a starting point.
And that, and also raising two boys, you know, you've got grandsons and I now have three grandsons. Having, you know, it's a combination of, you know, having them be a little aware of she looks uncomfortable. So kind of a raising our sons to be a little bit more aware of that, too. You know, I know my boys, I always talked about, like, well, I'm such a mouth. I would come home and share things like that. And they would say, well, he said that. And I'd be like, yeah. And I, you know, so they kind of, I let them know that they have a part in this, too. But definitely with our young women, you know, and especially now with social media and sexting and all this stuff, these young women are assuming these roles. Mm-hmm. Very young age, very sexual.
Did you hear about that? There was an app, of course, that was with regards to consent. So, you know, a couple is going to have some kind of encounter. And so they're doing all this agreeing ahead of time about what the parameters of this encounter would look like. And hopefully you hear what the problem is in that, because the idea of consent is an ongoing conversation.
Yes.
And so to say, I'm going to agree with all of these things up front. Well, what happens if you get halfway into whatever mm-hmm. this encounter is? And now you're like, you know what? I'm changing my mind. And now you've got, you know, your agreement.
A prenup before you've even done anything.
Exactly. You have no complaint.
This is Bridging the Gap on KVRF Radio Free Palmer. Today we're discussing the Me Too movement, sexual harassment, and pay inequality. I have Lisa Boyles, Roxanne Puckett, and Judy Getty here. Is there any danger of innocent men being falsely accused and being damaged by false accusations?
I think probably not going to be a crappy guy, you're probably not going to get very many accusations against you. But I'm sure that everybody's capable of being a liar, but I'm sure it could happen. I'm sure it does happen. But I think on the grander scale of things, it probably isn't going to be something that's going to be happening as much as people actually being accused for something that they actually did, personally. But I think it does happen. But what is innocence? What is that really? What's that definition of that man? Is he sheltered, never been out of in the city or been around a woman in his entire life and then accidentally just says, hey, how you doing? And was raised differently out in the woods? Or is he really just saying, I'm innocent because I want you to believe I'm innocent? That's kind of where I think there's a gray area. Because you have to, who's lying? That's what's happening right now. It's a he said, she said. And we know that there's 94 people who've gone women against this Harvey guy. But they still say that they're all lies. So I think it's a gray area. But.
Yeah, I guess I think when it comes to money, you're always going to have liars. I mean, I think male mm-hmm. and female. I mean, the guy that played Elmo was falsely accused. Well, or so we heard, falsely accused, you know, and it was embezzlement. You know, they will come out. And so, you know, that's going to happen when money's involved, no matter what, male or female. I think you're up against that. But I do think, going back to what I said, there are some hypersensitive people out there. And you know, like that lady engineer I worked with, she was very, you know, and we had to be very careful, male and female, what we said around her. So, yeah, there might be some. But I think when it gets to be too big, like a Harvey Weinstein thing, you know, that says you're going to err on the side of, wow, he's big. You know, there's, you don't have. But when you're like talking about someone in a business and it might be a miscommunication, you really want to try to see both sides, you mm-hmm. know.
And again, back to the Aziz Ansari situation, some women responded with, you know, if there's a few innocent men that have to go down, we're going to believe the women. And this one writer was saying, well, You know, that's not exactly the position we want to take either. But it's
I don't like that position at all.
No. Well, and so her thing was trust and investigate. I mean, I think with anything, whether we're talking about a workplace situation that's a sexual harassment that requires some kind of human resources response versus a criminal justice response kind of incident, you're going to investigate that. There's process for both of those things. And if a complaint is made, whether it's civil or criminal, people should follow that due process and look into it and try to make a determination if it's authentic or what is going on.
How widespread do you think this problem is?
I think it's a whole world, but personally.
I think actually, you know, raising daughters, it happened to my daughter in grade school. And, you know, it's very widespread. It's a culture. Unfortunately, I really firmly believe, and like you, if you watch Family Guy, just an example, a lot of the jokes are, you know, honey, get back in the kitchen, and women are stupid, and ha, you know, and so we still perpetuate, and he could be just making fun of those people that talk like
that. I think that is satire.
It is. But I can tell you, my boys certainly laughed really loud when that stuff, you know, so it's pretty prevalent, and I think it's just going to be like a slow way of, like we talked about, approaching our women, our young girls, our little babies and our sons, you know, and really trying to change that culture, you know, trying to change that, you know, because I don't want to, you know, someone to do it angrily, because we've seen that, you know, while just hiring women. You know, I was in an environment where men would get mad because a woman got a job over a man. Mm-hmm. And that was, we create, you know, some, you know, I guess I'm going to have to like this person now, you know. But anyway, Judy, you probably have a lot to say.
Well, and I'm just thinking we're in an interesting time because I think that in some regards, what our current president has allowed is to bring out some of the worst now that people are willing to put out there, these things. And there's somebody running for an office in Missouri, and his Facebook page says, you know, that he believes in women's equality and women's opportunities and that women can do, but they better have dinner on the table at 6. Well, you know, what kind of garbage is that? You know, it's still coming from this position of male privilege. Mm-hmm. And so I think it, you know, like Lisa said, it's so ingrained and so embedded that, you know, we have to, you know, bring the change on many different levels.
I agree. Yeah. It's like that 50s stereotype, you know, with the cute dress and the dinner, and you never get to think for yourself. And it's just like, and I think it depends on regional, too. We talk about culture, and then inside our culture, we have all these little tiny brackets. You know, you've got the Appalachian Mountains, or up here, you've got a lot of break in. You've got a lot of old school, you know, that kind of are just set in their ways. And, of course, they raise their children that way. So that's why I think we're having so many conflicts with this kind of outdated way of thinking, the stereotypical way of thinking about the woman because of the way they're raised. And you've got people who are 20 years old or whatever, who are raised in the city, maybe who had a different, there's a lots of subgroups inside subgroups. And it has to start at the higher to change it because of that. I don't know how it's going to happen, but I do know that that's a serious problem. I see it all the time.
I want to get to this question before we run out of time. I've already briefed you all on the fact that I was going to ask this question. Have you, in your experience as a woman in the business or in the working world, ever encountered any boorish men who needed to be told to back off? How did you manage to handle that situation at that time? And are you satisfied that you had enough power at the time to produce a positive result? Lisa, we'll start with you.
Yes, especially working you know, 20 plus years ago in a male-dominated field. One incident in particular, and like I said, my workmates, the daily workmates, we kind of knew our boundaries. They were like my brothers and sisters, you know. But these tended to be people coming in from the lower 48. And I had to get out of a situation that I didn't expect. I kind of was under false pretenses, was lured to this hotel room, which I can people thinking, oh, you went to his hotel, but I thought other people were going to be there. It was supposed to be like an after hours, you know, we're all going to gab and then just go back. And it wasn't that. It was quite the opposite. And I had to get out. I was very explicit in my no, this isn't appropriate. I'm leaving now. But as far as making a difference, nope. I think he just said, oh, well, didn't get some tonight. And that was it. And I don't think it made a difference. I really think at that point, and you're talking almost 20 years ago, 15 plus years ago, it was a good old boy network, and it just didn't happen to work out this time. But that's not, I don't think it made him feel any different about the next woman he
did. Did you report it at all? Did you have any mechanism?
No, I didn't. I did have mechanism to report it, but I was also one of the few female managers within this entity, and no, I did not report it. And that you did feel at that point you would have a history, and it would be duly noted in your chart, as I say, you know, you cause trouble. You're a troublemaker, or you don't work well around other people. I let it go. I considered it an isolated incident. But, you know, looking back, it probably wasn't. Like I said, I could see him probably doing it to the next young woman in the next area that he went. He was, an upper salesman, that regional salesman that would go and visit specific regions. So I wish I had. There was a way of going about it, but it was such a long process that a lot of women didn't. Unless it happened repeatedly. So an isolated incident probably would not have been reported, but had this been behavior he showed every time he came up, then we would feel more empowered to do it, something about it.
Roxanne?
Well, I haven't – I've had customers – I've worked in retail for a long time, so I've actually had worse experiences with the male customers. And this is interesting because I worked up here, and I had a male boss, supervisor, and he was – never made me feel uncomfortable ever one time. But I had a customer come in. He would come in all the time. I used to call him the old cowboy, which is a stereotype. He had a cowboy hat. He's probably 60 years old. Real nice, always flirty with me. Now, I've been in male-dominated since my mom. I worked in a lumber yard when I was 14 and then on the books at 16. And there I learned that you just have to deal with it. You just
How did you deal with it?
You just, when they flirt with you and they tell you, you can't give me my lumber because you're a woman and you're not good enough. And that's what I've had a man tell me when I was 16 years old. And my female supervisor said, pushed me away a little bit and stepped in and said, he's just one of those guys. You're just going to have to deal with him like that. That's the first lesson of yours. So that was when I was 16. And here I am. I'm working in a register. There's no back in the back. Anybody could come up behind you. This guy, like I said, had come in, nicer dude. Came in super drunk, and I had a bunch of customers, female, and he came up and he was flirting, and I just kind of, you kind of like get into the situation, you're like in a fight or flight, and you're just protecting yourself. Here I am, a manager, 23 years old, female, and there's no time, I guess. I just didn't think it was a priority to worry about this guy. Well, he came up behind me and grabbed me and got right up on me. I mean, right up on me. And I still didn't realize. I thought, why don't you just go home? My actual personality, anybody who I tell this to, are shocked because I didn't punch him in the face. Because at any other time, I'm kind of crappy. I'm very aggressive. But I didn't that time. I was very, I was worried about rocking the boat and I just try to make things comfortable.
Were you worried about yourself getting in trouble? By punching him or something, overreacting?
Yeah, I was worried about that. And then I guess I didn't really know how my bosses would react. And they reacted amazingly. They found out. I didn't report it. I didn't say anything. And somebody else actually did, one of the girls who watched it happen. And I was like, this is just a regular day. And my boss came unglued, called the troopers. He was there was a file reported on it. And he was never allowed back into any of the company's stores. And that, for me, that was about 3 years ago. That was my boss. That was my direct supervisor who did that. And he was like, I can't, you call me. That ever happens to you again, you punch him in the freaking, you just do it. You just get it. Yeah, he was just, he goes, you got to be, that's unacceptable.
I think what we're talking about now is what we just suggested earlier, yeah. That if the man sees the injustice, yeah. And actually engages in it to a positive result.
And it makes a huge, huge difference. And that same manager going on to a kind of a coworker, I had this coworker, he didn't like me. I'm very, like I said, I'm 23 years old running a store and when the other guys aren't there. And I had to ask him to go do a task. And he said, you must be on the rag today. Jeez. And I said, yes, I just got you fired. Said that right to his face, went to my boss, and he fired him.
Good.
So that was... Woo-hoo. After a lot of really long, terrible experiences where I didn't feel was 16 and down in California at that lumber place, and I just didn't. That's just how it is. That's how it was. I was raised by loggers who were back in the woods and, you know, good old boys, blue collar. You don't like it, you can get out. That's how I was raised. And so now that I've had that experience with a really incredible supervisor, male.
It's empowered you.
It has empowered me. So I'm like, awesome. Bring it on. But not
and I hope that is a sign of things to come. Yeah.
It is. And that was just in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's really important, really special. So.
Judy, can you share with us about...
Okay, mine are going to be two pretty frivolous kinds of things, but I think it goes to just how subtle these things can be, and I think it also... are there good examples
well,
of how...
Well, if there's subtlety exposed here, then that's not frivolous at all.
Well, and I think, too, that it just, again, yeah, it does show how embedded this is. So I worked in corrections for 20 years, so certainly male-dominated. And so one situation, and I think, you know, you can see this now in schools with dress codes, that somehow girls are supposed to dress so not to distract boys. So it becomes, it's always the girl's fault, we lead men on or whatever. So I was working in a correctional facility, and one of the other supervisors came to me and pointed out that one of the women who worked for me, that he was getting complaints about the pants she wore and how they hugged her.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him to tell the man who complained to quit looking at her backside. And, but I don't know if he did that. But I think the look on his face was worth it, because it was, again, that example of where, oh, now, woman, change the way you are, because it's making the men's eyes go where they mm-hmm. shouldn't be going, and they're uncomfortable with that. So, and then another one, I followed a woman at this one work site, and she had a penchant for, keeping snacks in her office. And so there'd be pretzels or licorice or whatever, and the male co-workers would come in and look for snacks. And so when I took over her office, there was these snacks, and then eventually there were no snacks. And so I was leaving for the day, and one of the men yelled out from the office, "Judy, you need to go to the store and get some more licorice." And I said, "I'm pretty sure you know where the store is, too." And, that was going to be the line that, no, I'm not your mom. I'm not going to provide your snacks for you. Help yourself. And I think that I think that when women challenge men on just those small things, mm-hmm. I mean, I really like your stories, Roxanne, because I think it's so important to have a good immediate consequence for these mm-hmm. men
yes,
who behave badly.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's on many levels that women have to respond, I think.
Stand up to the goon.
If you're able
to, yeah.
We all know what happened to the Occupy Wall Street movement. Does this movement have the legs to make a permanent cultural difference, or will it end up like Occupy Wall Street as an historical asterisk?
I think the Occupy Wall Street movement, one of the complaints was that they had no end game. What did they want? What was it going to be that they were going to accomplish?
And does this have an end game?
I don't know. I think that right now what it's doing is giving people voice. Mm-hmm. And so people are coming out and telling their stories. I think it is prompting discussion in Congress, at least, with regards to what are our rules going to be when, we get a complaint like this within our circle of
You mean like in the state of Alaska?
No,
I know they've been talking about that too.
I think the conversation is coming up probably in a lot of places about what's going to be our response when we, mm-hmm. have these kinds of issues. But otherwise, we've had sexual harassment training in the workplace forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think maybe just
very
women...
bad sexual harassment training, I might add. I worked in corrections too, so I had a lot of that as well.
But I think it's a good starting point. Place to have women feel that they could tell their stories.
Absolutely. And they kind of like that media I was talking about earlier, it's there's like a big group. You don't feel alone. Even just the Me Too, it's a hashtag. Yeah, it's just a thing that some people are saying, well, who really cares? You're just pushing a button and what's going to happen at the end? Well, at least they've started something. At least they feel comfortable enough to say it for themselves and then for a group. And I think that if this keeps going, the Grammys. That was in the. It was in the Grammys. It was in. It's kind of saturating everything in our regular cultural, and things like that.
Yeah.
So clearly, this isn't just a small little two-button, two-word thing on a Twitter account. This is this has been happening for hundreds of years.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it opened up discussion with my son's fiance and her, and they're younger. They're in their early 20s and her friends. And all of a sudden we started talking about sexting. And, and I told them, I said, it's going to be your girls to tell, you know, train these girls not to do that with their phones. And because, you know, it just opened up such discussions of empowerment and say no. And how these girls are starting to say no. And if they feel creeped out by some responses on Facebook, they block them. And so I think you're right. I think well, women are in charge in this. So we'll probably get something done.
Right. I hope. But
yeah.
I do know that something on a higher level has to be done for this to move forward. Yeah, we could keep talking about it. And I think the more families, like you're saying, the more households that keep talking about it because of this kind of openness of it, maybe it will just keep growing up to those higher levels of, and just the conversation hopefully won't just be one and done, if you will. Just let's talk about it. Oh, it's a big deal. Gosh, this is getting crazy in politics. Maybe it's still all blow over. Well, I hope not. And I hope that it gets, like you're saying, that more families are open about talking to their family members about it. And then kind of spreading a big tree of
And men
awareness.
Who are behaving badly are afraid of being.
And they should be.
Put out. Yeah.
Because if they weren't doing that, they wouldn't have anything to worry about.
So you think it has legs? You think this thing is has a better chance of surviving than Occupy Wall Street?
Yes.
I do.
Okay. It's very personal.
Yeah.
Wall Street wasn't that personal.
Is there a need to rewrite the rules for non-disclosure clauses in employee contracts when it comes to any criminal, but especially sexual misconduct? Right now we have these non-disclosure clauses in contract. I think Stormy Daniels had one. Where she was not supposed to say anything, where she got her $130,000, but she wasn't supposed to say anything about what happened with Donald. And any other settlement that comes in after an accusation of sexual misconduct has this non-disclosure clause, which protects people like Harvey Weinstein and Bill O'Reilly and people like that. Is there a need right now, as one of the fundamental results of this movement, to rewrite those non-disclosure clauses from a legal basis?
Absolutely. I don't think you should have any chance of being, you know, let's just shut this up. I don't think you should be allowed to pay somebody to not talk about it. I don't. What's the point? You're shushing it up.
I'll make it real fast. I know we're winding up, but I just actually saw something on a lot of people on the right side want to know who got money for us taxpayers' dollars to. They're trying to release the victims
for Congress, for the congressional.
And so there's a yin and a yang, or a, you know, a bad and a good to this one, because you know, should women be protected? But I do think that, you know, if someone does get fired for that, I think we should be able to disclose, you know, especially if it's a predatorial thing, or you know, something that's happening regularly, frequently, whatever, or and then they went through some kind of training and it didn't change.
So are you saying that women should have the right not to reveal themselves, but also have the right to reveal what happened? Is that what you're saying?
I kind of like in a rape situation, yeah. You know, we don't release the victims of the rape names unless the victims, they should have that option, you know, because they're victims, you know. There wouldn't be money dispersed if they weren't a victim. Judy, go ahead.
No, I agree. I think that it should be up to the victim. And so if they're wanting to tell the story, that part of a settlement should not be, you cannot.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, yeah, cannot. Exactly.
Right.
But
yeah.
It shouldn't
but
be.
But if they don't want to because they don't want to put their name out there, then that's up to them.
Yeah. But the men, as far as looking for another job, especially when it's predatorial or it happens way more than once, definitely I think that should be something disclosed. And I firmly believe that with anything, you know, we have a lot.
Any criminal activity.
I think so.
Right.
I really do.
Excuse it constantly. Why not do something about it instead of paying everybody off?
Tell priests were moved around.
We have had a great discussion here, ladies. And even if you are all lovely, I want to thank you for coming in. And Lisa Boyles, Roxanne Puckett, Judy Getty, appreciate so much for coming in and sharing this. I learned a lot today, and I hope our tech guy over there, Mike, learned a lot too. He sure did. He gave us a thumbs up on that. So this is Bridging the Gap, and another episode over. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.